Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your music against me of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
There was a resistance on her part. She didn't want to go into this conservatorship because, as you can imagine, you know, looking at it from her vantage point from a distance, entering a world of these kinds of restrictions and oversight is not appealing.
We're coming at you with a newsy episode this week. It's been a lot of activity in the Britney Spears conservatorship case. If you dig deep into Popcast archives, if you go back to the Ratliff era, another golden era, two golden eras back to back, I like to think of them. If you go back to the Ratliff era, 2016, there is an episode about Britney pegged to an investigative piece that the Times did about the Britney conservatorship and her legal status. That was 4 years ago. This is now. A lot has changed. So we are going to go long on Britney today. First, your friend and mine, Joe Coscarelli, is going to come through. Joe is going to talk about the recent developments in the case and also talk about the time that he went to Vegas to take a Polaroid with Britney Spears as part of a reporting trip. Secondarily, our old friend, Vanessa Gregoriadis, is calling in. Vanessa did a very important piece in 2008 where she spent many, many, many weeks, possibly many months, embedded with and around the many, many grifters in the Britney Spears extended universe. It was for Rolling Stone. It was really the first article that got under the hood of what was going on in the Britney world. And this was during a time when Britney was all over the tabloids, mostly doing things that were worrisome and troubling. And Vanessa did a lot of reporting to figure out exactly what was going on with the people who were in her circle or were trying very, very hard to be in her circle. You'll remember Vanessa from when she was previously on Popcast, talking about long-form celebrity journalism. Vanessa still does that. She writes for the Times Magazine, amongst others, and also, as with everybody, has started a podcast company. It's called Campside, and they have a podcast that's in process now. It's called Chameleon Hollywood Con Queen. Vanessa is going to be here reliving the magazine glory days, which predate the podcast glory days. And I think, if I'm going to be honest, even though this is a podcast and I host a podcast, they were probably cooler, just to keep it a buck. Anyway, starting off, Joe Coscarelli is calling in. Joe, hey.
Hello.
In my home office, I have a lot of things on the walls. What I don't have, and what I should have, is a photo print of you and Britney Spears backstage in Las Vegas when you went in 2016 to scope out the operation.
One of my first Instagram posts of all time, I think, is a photo of my photo with Britney Spears. And I will tell the story at the end. I think I may have told it on a past podcast
I
in
think
2016.
So. That's okay.
Yeah, I'll retell back. It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm expecting a copy of that, like frame Bridget for me or something, you know, like I'm expecting a copy of that sometime later this year near the holidays. You have been on the Britney beat intermittently for the last few years. Let's start by talking about what's happening right now. Then we'll give some of the broader context. There's been recently some development in the Britney conservatorship. What's been happening in the most recent court filings and decisions?
I first wrote about Britney Spears' conservatorship along with Serge Kovaleski, a New York Times investigative reporter. Shout out to Serge.
A real Don.
A true legend. It was a real thrill to have him on the culture desk for a couple of years and to be able to work on a story like this. So that was more than 4 years ago. And at the time, there really wasn't much going on in the conservatorship, which started in 2008 and basically has run Britney's financial and personal life since she broke down and shaved her head and all that. And for years and years and years, there was basically no movement because things seemed to be like ticking along pretty well. Like her career bounced back, her health bounced back.
Right. Just for context, the conservatorship was granted. Was it in 08 or 09? Somewhere right around there.
It was in early 08 and it became permanent by the end of that year.
So it was granted then, which was sort of just after kind of like peak tabloid era Britney. And then what happened throughout the course of the 2010s is Britney continued to put albums out. She did an actual tour. She had a Vegas residency. Things began to look like what you might expect from any star of her stature. Maybe like not quite as mobile and out there, but broadly speaking, she had restored her career to a functioning and, depending on the court filing, lucrative level.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying now that, you know, she has basically like $60 million cash, whereas when this conservatorship started, she was in the red. They did this in part to save her life, but also to save her bank account. And then what's been happening this summer, which you've slowly started to see, I would say the first sort of rupture happened in January 2019, but in August, you got really the first time Britney has ever come out in court and said that she wants this arrangement to change. And that was done on her behalf by a lawyer, this guy, Samuel Ingham, who's been her court-appointed lawyer since the conservatorship started in 2008. And his job, he's basically paid by the court, by taxpayers, basically, and some by the conservatorship as well. And his role is as an advocate for the conservatee. So she did not hire him. He was assigned to her because when the conservatorship started, it was decided by a judge that she was not in any mental state to be able to hire her own lawyer. So they gave her one.
Is it notable that her court-appointed lawyer has remained the same for more than a decade?
I think it's such a complex and unique situation that, and he didn't really do anything. You know, he was basically just saying, you know, everything's good for a decade. But I think he probably knew the ins and outs. She was comfortable with him. The other side, you know, her father and the other conservators were comfortable with him. He was basically being paid almost, I think, double what a normal court-appointed conservator would be paid because this was such a complicated situation. So in August, after some back and forth in the filings, she basically came out and said via Ingham that she wanted this arrangement to change. And chiefly what she wanted was that her father no longer be involved.
And her father has been the personal conservator for the most of the duration of this 12-year arrangement. However, her father had some health issues maybe about a year and a half ago, and then another person was appointed as a temporary personal conservator. And the current request that Britney's lawyer had filed was that that person could be appointed the permanent conservator. Is that correct?
Right. So the way conservatorships work in California is that you can have a financial conservatorship, which is basically control of your estate, your bank account and your investments and your properties and all that. And then a personal conservatorship, which is in charge of your personal life, basically, you know, mental health care, taking, you know, medication. A lot of this is private because Britney is a celebrity and the filings are redacted, but taking care of her household, her custody arrangement, that's the personal side. And Britney had both, and she's had both this whole time.
Were any reasons given for her request to specifically have her father removed as the conservator?
They haven't really come out and said in the court filings. Her lawyer in court this last week said that, you know, she hasn't spoken to her father in a long time. A lawyer for her mother, Lynn, said that they had a toxic relationship. Her mother said that her father had referred to her as a racehorse that needed to be treated like one. So you get these glimpses of it, but they haven't come out and said. Now, at the same time, any like real Britney fan will know that her relationship with her father has been rocky throughout her whole life.
Yeah, we should give the context, the long arc of context with her father.
They're from small town Louisiana. You know, she came from nowhere, really, really nowhere. And he was a welder. He was an oil worker. He was a cook. He was a regular Louisiana guy. And he was also an alcoholic in her childhood. Her mom, Lynn Spears, has a book that came out in 2008, right around the end of this tabloid stuff, right after the conservatorship started, called Through the Storm. That's actually amazing. It's the most insightful thing I've ever read about Britney Spears, weirdly. And she really goes there. And, you know, she says that Jamie Spears, Britney's father, was verbally abusive, that he had erratic behavior, that he abandoned the family. and that he was a heavy drinker, basically. But he quit drinking, and seemingly in the depths of Britney's breakdown, her parents became a united front again. They divorced, but then they got back on good enough terms in order to save their daughter's life. Lynn, in the book, the craziest part is she talks about how Jamie like fasted and prayed for days before going to court and asking for this conservatorship because he was trying to find the answer with God. And in the years after that, by all accounts, things went pretty well. Like, it worked. And I think you saw that in seeing Britney come back from the brink. She would post on Instagram relatively happy things about Jamie. There would be some family photos together. You know, it seemed like things were smoothed out. And then about a year ago, you start to see reports in the tabloids that there's been a break between them. And, you know, there's some stuff about Jamie. This is all according to like TMZ and Page Six and The Blast. And this is now reporting that we have confirmed, but they said that there was an incident where Jamie and one of Britney's sons, her teenage son, had an argument and he yelled at him or shook him or something. They took out a restraining order against him. There was some beef with Kevin Federline, and there seems to have been a split.
Was this at Federline's house, maybe, or something along those?
Yeah, I would think that's how it's reported. So there seemed to be a break. And if you're following the timeline, if you're doing this sort of like yarn conspiracy theory map on your wall with Britney and the conservatorship, this is the time when there seems to be a huge rupture in the conservatorship. And there are reports that Britney went back to a mental hospital around this time.
There's also what happens with her father's health, which leads to, at the beginning of 2019, a big shift in Britney's professional obligations. You want to talk about that a little bit?
So in January 2019, Britney announces that she's going on an indefinite work hiatus. She had signed a deal for a new Vegas residency. You know, she performed at the Planet Hollywood, where I saw her, from 2013 all the way up till 2017. It was hugely lucrative. They sold a ton of tickets. She did the same show basically every night that she performed. It seemed like a great fit for her. And then another hotel in Vegas signed her up for a variation on that show for a ton of money.
Wait, should I interrupt here and say that I am pretty sure that one of the first times that me and Karen ever really hung out, like really, really intensely, was at opening night or one of the opening nights of the Britney Vegas residency. Should we just say that? Because I feel like it's important character arc development history for Popcast fans.
Yeah, I've heard legend of this.
There's a lot of things that Karen and I talked about on that trip that we can't get into. Just like very there's a lot of like table setting for like the subsequent years of our lives happened on that particular trip at whatever dinner we were having. We'll save that for Popcast Uncut, the glory years.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
It was quite a chat. But I just Googled. So this is December. Man, I was here between Christmas and New Year's 2013.
Yeah, I mean, December 27th was the first show. December 27th, 2013. Was that the one you guys were at?
It must have been, because this is dated the 29th. So maybe it was the second show that I went to, that maybe we, and the headline of this piece is Heckfire and Brimstone. LOL. I didn't write that. Anyway,
this is before the New York Times knew what SEO was. So you still had headlines right. Like that.
Right. That's true. There is no, it's unsearchable. It's an unsearchable review.
Like every New York Times piece before Karen got here, basically.
Totally true. Anyway, a real glory moment. Hello to Karen, who I'm sure is listening and excited to relive that particular dinner.
So when Britney cancels everything and basically says, I'm not going to be a pop star for a while, she initially says that it's because of her father's health. She says that he had a ruptured colon. She says he almost died. And she's saying that that's why she's no longer going to perform in Vegas. And she doesn't know basically when she'll be back.
We have no reason to doubt that something did actually go wrong with her father's health, though, sure, correct?
Right.
But it also seems that that potentially was the beginning of a series of events that led to what's happening in the current, like, last few months.
Yeah, so later that year, 2019, is when you start to hear that Kevin Federline is accusing Jamie Spears of abusing their teenage son, according to the tabloids. And that's when what seemed like a rupture with Britney's career then becomes a family issue.
So basically, Britney had put in this request and it was just denied by the judge, correct?
I mean, it's complicated. They're asking for a lot of things at once. She's asking that a corporate fiduciary comes on as the co-conservator of her estate. She would like it to be the sole conservator of her estate, but the judge said her father's going to stick around for now. But the judge said that she'll hear arguments against Jamie in the future. So there's a lot of moving parts in this. There's the personal conservatorship, which is now being run by a professional conservator. There's Jamie trying to bring back Andrew Wallet, this lawyer who ran the financial side of things with him for most of the time this thing has existed. And they're basically dueling in court to see who has control over this thing. And the through line is that Brittany and now her mother want Jamie out.
And now it's worth noting that the relationship between Brittany and her father has been troubled, but also at different points, the relationship between Brittany and her mother has been troubled.
They always try to put forth a pretty, you know, rosy portrait, but I think, as with any child star, there are a lot of bumps in the road. And the fact that Brittany has been seemingly the breadwinner for this family since she was 16 years old, you can't overstate how weird that is. And
the dynamic is just so bizarre.
And I think that that's where you get this Free Britney stuff, which has really ratcheted up in the past few months.
Let's talk a little bit about the Free Britney stuff. I mean, we are no strangers on podcast or at the New York Times to both, number one, very aggressive fan armies, number two, conspiracy theories, and 2A, the intersection of those two things. What is going on with hashtag Free Britney?
The Free Britney campaign has been around since the conservatorship started, basically. You know, when we did that first piece on Britney Spears in 2016, we spoke to this kid, Jordan, who had this Britney Spears fan site called breatheheavy.com. And in 2009, he had started the Free Britney movement, you know, along with other super fans. And it was so intense at that moment that he recalled Jamie calling him personally and being like, if you don't take this down, we're going to have a problem.
That's also like a very 2009. Like, can you imagine someone in 2020 like trying to like whack-a-mole every person?
Right.
It's just like fundamentally impossible.
Since then, there has been a very vocal subset of huge, passionate Britney Spears fans, who I'm sure we'll hear from after this podcast. And they believe basically that the conservatorship is controlling Britney and potentially forcing her to perform to make money for other people. This all started from obviously a pretty innocent place. The conservatorship was started in 2008. By spring of 2009, Britney Spears was back on tour. And there's this MTV documentary from the time where she sort of makes a little bit of fuss about it, where she says like she thinks it's too in control and that basically saying that she feels like this caged bird. And I think given how much Britney fans know about her volatile relationship with her family and her father in particular, I think it's just never sat right with them that she's been making all these millions and yet she can't make any decisions about her life without a whole team of people signing off on it. And they survived a period in which Britney basically did not really acknowledge their existence. But now that she's come out and said, I need this conservatorship to change, in her court filings, she has basically shouted them out and said, like, thank you, and I need you, and you're right, essentially. And that's only fired them up more. I think, you know, you have these fans who are looking into her business management, which is stuff you don't even hear about from pop stars. Like, I don't think most people even know what a business manager does, but you know, they're picketing outside of offices and spamming people with phone calls, and they're doing all this Kremlinology on her Instagram account.
We haven't even mentioned the Instagram account. The Instagram account, tremendous. Like a tremendous pop star in repose. There's artworks, there's dance routines that feel very like off the cuff, but also very involved, like involved, yes, but off the cuff. It's one
there's
of
one top. She's always wearing, yeah, one top, basically.
It's probably, I don't want to say it's the best celebrity Instagram account, but it's top 10 for sure.
It's definitely the most interesting.
For sure. It's the most interesting. And because of that, I have a question. The answer is unknowable, but I want to know what you think about it, which is, what do you think the difference is, if any, between public-facing Britney and private existing Britney over the last, say, 18 months, 2 years. Do you think that every day she's strategizing with lawyers, she's taking meetings, she's being ruthless and focused on all the big picture financial and legal issues that she has to address? And then she's not showing any of that to the public via her public statements? Or do you think that other people are handling that for her, and what you're seeing on Instagram, which is basically most of what you're seeing, is really where she's at? Unknowable.
Yeah, unknowable, of course. But, you know, I've done a lot of reporting on Britney. I've spoken to a lot of people who know Britney, you know, on the record and off. And I feel like I know enough to be able to say that what Britney Spears cares about in life is her children first, her family, and music in a far second place, right? She loves dancing. She loves music. But mostly she likes watercolors and her sons. So I think what you see on her Instagram is what she wants to be doing. Do I think that she wants to be making albums competing with Billie Eilish? No. Do I think she wants to be in Vegas 100 nights a year? Probably not. If it were up to her, she would be in the woods with her family, like barefoot, dancing to Justin Timberlake. You know, like... Which she has done on the Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it's worth noting, you know, we've talked about Britney's Vegas residencies and tours and, like, basically the work that she did, especially in the 2010s. We haven't really talked about Britney's music. And 2008 is the last year that Britney released a notable album.
You fight them over Femme Fatale, okay, and Britney Jean.
Okay. There are three albums. I'm just going to let's just spell it out. There are three albums subsequent to 2008. 2008 album is called Circus, a very of the day album title reflective of longstanding chaos that was soon to come to an end.
Bathroom, is she smoking up outside? Oh, oh, baby, baby, does she take a piece of lime for the drink that I'm a buyer? Do you know just what?
In 2011, there's Femme Fatale. Maybe some stuff on there. Maybe some stuff.
I got all tricked out and it came up to this thing. Looking so fire, hot, 20 out of 10. I saw you watching me, watching you on the floor. Hitting me up like, what you waiting for?
2013, Britney Jean.
You want a hot body?
2016, Glory. Maybe Karen should call in to talk about Glory or Britney Jean.
Yeah. I actually don't know off the top of my head which ones of these Karen rides for, but I will say, this is the only thing that I'll say about Britney's music, Till the World Ends on Femme Fatale is a banger. And the remix with Kesha, also a banger. I know we don't listen to Dr. Luke anymore, some of us.
Yes.
But that's like a smash. That's one of the best Britney Spears songs of all time.
Also worth noting, in 2016, which is on Glory, both G-Eazy and Tinashe are on Glory. So maybe this is a low-key tastemaker record. Is this a low-key tastemaker record?
I don't think that Tinashe made the album. Did she? I know she was on a song around that period, but I don't know if she made the album.
According to Wikipedia, Slumber Party was on Glory. I don't know.
It's Slumber Party. We got them candles hanging.
But I think there's a version of Slumber Party without her, no?
Possible. I've got to assume that whoever is keeping up the Britney discography Wikipedia is, like, on it.
Okay, fair enough.
Don't you think?
I think Tinashe was added after the fact is what it was. When it was put out as a single, she was on it.
Oh, man. I'm just, like, I'm sweat. My sweat is growing at the sheer thought. Okay, but maybe low-key, what I'm trying to say, and in an olive branch gesture, is maybe low-key there is some tastemakery stuff happening on this record.
Right. Well, were there ever Britney Spears albums where songs mattered that weren't singles? Don't spam my inbox, please, listeners. But are there Britney Spears album cuts that matter?
First two albums, probably not. But also, there were like 9 singles on all those albums.
That's what I mean. But I, yeah. I think we heard, you know, whether you were listening to Britney Spears albums front to back, you heard all the good Britney Spears songs.
That is probably fair. I'm not going to dispute it.
Again,
I'm
don't say, at me.
No, don't no, don't at, me. Don't at Joe. Don't make Joe go private. Joe doesn't want to go private. It's like the holidays. It's a pandemic. We're about to be locked in the house again. Please don't make Joe go private. Fair? Fair question. Fair request. The judge specified that they would entertain future arguments in terms of removing the possibility of removing Jamie as conservator. Now, is that boilerplate? Is that generic? Or is that a crack in the window and the light starting to come in?
You know, that's a question for a lawyer. I think we haven't seen the last of this. This is an active situation, and I think a lot will continue to change in the conservatorship. I just keep coming back to the same fundamental question that we had when we first wrote this story, right? A conservatorship is something that is usually for people who cannot take care of themselves. It's for the very old. It's for the very ill. Either Britney Spears is so sick, so mentally ill, that she needed this type of control on her life for 10 years, which, if that's the case, maybe she shouldn't have been one of the biggest pop stars in the world during that same period. Or she's healthy enough to be a pop star, and therefore these limitations on her life are insane. It's one or the other. And now you have even organizations like the ACLU stepping in and saying, if Britney wants her civil liberties back, we're going to help her. This is potentially a human rights question. And I think now that Britney has basically said, my life is different. Like, I'm not going to be a world-class entertainer anymore. I just think there's no way this thing doesn't get loosened. If she's for the first time advocating for herself and saying, I don't need this level of care, I think a judge has to listen to that. This is a 30-something year old woman who has lived under this arrangement for more than a decade, who is now saying, I'm good. I don't need this anymore. So there's something to that. You know, I think Ingham broke down the conservatorship, her lawyer, into 3 phases. You know, he said the first was triage. That's rescuing her from collapse and exploitation and financial ruin. The second phase was her comeback.
And that was a success.
That was a success. The second phase was the comeback. She becomes a top-tier pop star again. That was a success. Now she's saying, I'm not going to be that anymore. My life is different. I'm not going to perform for the foreseeable future. There's no album coming out. Does she want people to watch over her finances so she doesn't become every other pop star who's gone broke? Like, definitely. I think she has no problem with a bank being in charge of her finances. But does she need all the rest of it? I think that's going to be the question moving forward.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to be doing annual Britney Spears conservatorship episodes. So we will circle back.
We promised the people my Britney Spears photo story. Should I do a quick version of it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, please.
So we put out this story in 2016. I went to the Piece of Me show as a fan to see what it was
like. I mean, like on assignment as a fan.
On a reporting mission, but not with access given by the Britney Spears camp. So what we did was we paid $1,500 plus Ticketmaster fees to get me the meet and greet. So, I mean,
shout out to all the editors who signed off on that. Shout out to every person.
Phil Corbett, I see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I feel like when I'm filing a particularly crazy expense account again, whenever that expense report again, whenever that might be, 2024 or whatever, I'm just going to say, well, Joe put in a $1,500 Britney Polaroid. Like, it's whatever. This is nothing.
Journalism is expensive. That's the lesson here. That is the takeaway. Good journalism is expensive. So I got a tour of backstage, me and, you know, 10 other super fans, including like some Chinese millionaires and some kids who had spent their whole life savings. And Felicia Culotta, who any Britney fan knows, that's been her handler and her pal since she was a teenager. She leads the tour. She brings you all around, shows you the set. And then at the end, you get to take your photo with Britney Spears before the show. So to do that, you have to go through basically like airport level security, right? You go through a metal detector, you put all your stuff in a basket, you know, they pat you down, and they finish the tour. And Felicia's like, all right, who's ready? Who's going to go first to meet Britney? And all of the super fans are so nervous that they're just sort of like looking at each other like, oh, like, I don't, you know, like, I don't know what to do. So I'm, you know, me, I'm there as a dispassionate observer, a fan in camo. And so I'm like, all right, I'll just go. I go through the airport security. I walk up to Britney Spears. She's wearing a fedora.
Yeah, the fedora.
Yeah, presumably. She's wearing the fedora. You know, she, I can't remember if we put our arms around each other or what, but it's very brief. I say, you know, break a leg tonight. She says, like, it's so good to see you.
And then you were like, blink twice if you want to be freed.
Yeah. And then they snap the photo, right? So they snap the photo on the on this digital camera. And I'm like, oh my God, thank you so much. You know, I'm also nervous because I'm there like as a New York Times reporter, but not announcing myself as such, which was approved again by our standards department. I was told if they asked what I did or why I was there, I would have to say, but I didn't have to offer the information myself because it was a publicly available ticket.
As opportunity, long as
you
yes.
buy it. Yeah. So, you know, I walk away, pick up my jacket, collect all my stuff, walk back out through security. And I see out of the corner of my eye that Britney goes to the photographer and she looks at the photograph on the screen. And, you know, I turn around and I literally walk out the door back into the night to go to my seat. And all of a sudden I get a tap on my shoulder and it's one of the security guards. And he says, Britney wants to retake the photo. She didn't like it. Ah! So I walk all the way back through security. They take another photo. She checks it again, and I guess it got the thumbs up. But I just couldn't help but think, like, this is Britney Spears. Like, there are not only more photos of her in the world, there are more unflattering photos of her in the world than almost anybody else to ever exist. And yet, she didn't know that anybody else besides me would ever see this. And she wanted to do it again. I'll never forget it.
And again, I'm expecting a framed copy for the holidays.
I do have a very big smile in the second one. I wish I had the first one as well.
Joe, talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Sometimes I run.
For part two of today's episode, we are going to go back in time. The arc of Britney Spears is long. I am not convinced it tilts towards justice. That is still TBD. It is certainly tilting away from some wild stuff. If you have been following Britney for decades, as I have, and I know Joe has, you know about the mid-2000 tabloid era Britney. And you know that there is one definitive piece of journalism capturing a lot of the madness of that era, and that is Vanessa Gregoriadis's 2008 Rolling Stone feature. Vanessa's been on podcasts before, and she is back to maximize our Britney awareness. Vanessa, hi.
Hey, John, how are you?
I am relieved, however momentarily, to be living in the past with you.
Back when things were so simple, but not for Britney.
No, although I have to say, given how 2020 has been, 2008 feels charming and almost small scale in its crazy, as captured in your piece. I reread this piece a couple times in the last few days getting prepped for this. And I had forgotten just how much woo is in this thing. I assume you revisited it. I assume you prepped up.
Well, as I asked you last night, I was like, do I need to bone up for this? And I went and I read this piece a couple of hours ago and I was like, damn, this is real. Like, I wrote this. I went through this. This is like my soul on the page. And I have to say that of all the pieces, you know, I've written like, I don't know, 100 or 200 like of these long features through 20 years of writing. This is the story that people remember, which is so unbelievable to me because it's not like, you know, I'm the Boswell of Britney Spears. I mean, this was just a random assignment, but I was living in LA at the time. And so I got really into it. Like I was like, oh, there's a place I can go. I can go to outside her house and I can meet these people who are saying they're managing her. And I can talk to the paparazzo who's like dating her. And it was just like this wonderland of like crazy town reporting for somebody who like loves to do shoe leather reporting. You know, this was a dream. So that's kind of why I got so into it. But it is an opus. I agree.
That is accurate. Let's set up a tiny bit of context for not necessarily specifically Britney in the mid-2000s, but I want to talk a little bit about the tabloid golden age of the mid-2000s, kind of peak Us Weekly era, right? The Britney saga is part of that. It's informed by it, shaped by it. And that era predates kind of like Britney breakdown by a few years. Can you talk a little bit about the way that tabloid coverage had evolved throughout the 2000s, ultimately setting the stage for what would be the full documentation of the Britney breakdown?
This is the height of tabloid culture, right? Was when she got ensnared in all of the craziness of cutting her hair and going to rehab and, you know, I mean, shaving her entire head and that crazy photo with the umbrella, umbrella and hitting the, you know, one of the paparazzo's cars. The fact is, like, TMZ opened their doors, you know, 30-mile zone, that's what it stands for. And, you know, their offices are in an unmarked building with, you know, no name on the door on Sunset and Fairfax. And it's the idea that they cover everything around that area. And they just, like, dug into all of the celebrities' lives. And it was a time when British paparazzos were coming over here. And there was just like this international hunger for stories about LA-based celebrities. It was kind of like before the reality show stars really started taking hold, you know, and it was obviously before Instagram or Facebook or any of that stuff. I was reading this piece and I was like, you know, none of this would have happened if everybody had just had a camera and they could take a picture of Britney Spears. It was because there was like this rabid group of paparazzi that were making their living off of her. And they were driving her to a degree, like, you know, just to extremes, because they were waiting outside her house, like packs of like hundreds of, you know, 100 guys, let's say something like that. I think I say it's like 75, you know, with cars and leading her on these crazy car chases. I mean, that was a big part of her life.
And to your point, it's not pre-internet in the sense that there is no internet, but it's pre-internet gossip. It's sort of maybe like blog era in actual internet, but it's not ubiquitous. It's not social media era internet. It's not everybody is covered all the time, all day long. Part of the thing about that era is there is a presumption of scarcity. You have a scarce commodity, which is the famous person. And therefore, you have all these paparazzo scrambling to get a tiny, tiny bit of this scarce thing because they know that there's a huge financial value attached to it. That has almost completely been washed away in the subsequent 15 years.
Yeah, you had the tabloids, you know, I mean, you had Wenner going and buying Us, right? At a time when Us was kind of beginning to look like it wasn't going to fare so well in this whole internet era. But, you know, people were still buying those tabloids in print form, and they were looking at blogs where they could see pictures of celebrities and they could see news, but it wasn't at the rate that things were coming at you now. And it was also, none of it was mediated by the celebrities itself. And we can talk about you know, Britney's current Instagram and how mediated that is, but you couldn't get like the stars kind of PR push where she just puts out what you want to see. Like, this was the flip side of the kind of Vanity Fairs of the world, right? Like, this was like, okay, we're going to really show you what's going on here. She's going to Starbucks and she looks bad.
And, it was rowdy. Like, that's the thing. The thing that I remember most vividly about that era was how rowdy the coverage was. How unhinged, both emotionally and also aesthetically. This is really when you start to see the de-aestheticization of celebrity coverage. Because even if you think of like classic, like Ron Galella type paparazzi stuff, there's still something kind of fashionable about it, you know? But here are people who are literally with like the cheapest or most accessible digital cameras that they can find, running around, shooting things from across the street, through a long lens, whatever it is. The aesthetics of celebrity coverage are completely thrown out the window, which therefore changes the type of celebrity that thrives in that particular environment. And Unwell Britney, unfortunately for Britney, was a very, very apt anti-hero of that era.
Totally. Because, you know, not only was she walking to the gas stations barefoot. I mean, that's a great shot right there, right? America's princess. Oh, yeah. Look what's going on. But then also, of course, the stuff with her kids driving around without the car seats, the kid in the front seat, you know, and she really embraced that trashy side of herself. Remember, you know, when she got married to Federline, they all wore like juicy tracksuits saying pimps and maids.
Very 2020 fashion.
That's true. We have gone back that way. And very COVID cozy.
Yes. Ooh, I like it.
Juicy tracksuits. But, you know, it was just the most delicious story that any of these people could get at that point. And, you know, she had that kind of Meghan Markle level fame where anything she did, any stop at like the 7-Eleven was something that was just like cha-ching, cha-ching.
So you mentioned before this story was an assignment. What exactly was the assignment? Go try to get an interview with Britney? Go and mesh yourself with the hangers-on? What was the original vibe?
Yeah, I think it was like a few months before she did the shaving of the head. They said, you know, something crazy is going on with Britney. You know, we've tried to get an interview with her and nobody's calling us back. And it was literally like, I would just not call you, you know? And, you know, she doesn't have her parents around. She doesn't have, you know, Larry Rudolph around. I mean, you know, she changed her phone numbers, essentially. So, you know, nobody could get in touch with her. She wasn't reaching out to anybody. And, you know, the idea was, I think, to do one of those big Rolling Stone interviews with her and try to get to the heart of the matter. But somehow I was going to accomplish this just myself, knocking on her door, I guess was the idea. And I said, you know, this just seems sketchy and down market. And this isn't something I want to do with my journalistic talents. And they were like, all right. And then like the rest of the world, we all saw the head shaving incident. And I started to say, okay, well, not at all to my credit. What I didn't say is this is a woman going through a mental breakdown and I should leave her alone. I said like, wow, looks like something very important is going on here. And I should really make sure I cover it with whatever sensational detail I can muster up. I do think that there's like a intensity of and vividness and depth to this piece that just comes by having talked to like 100 people who were around her at that time. And we started off talking about the economy, and it was an economy, and people, you know, she was hanging out of the Four Seasons almost every night. And I will never forget hanging out in that lobby bar with like all of these guys who owned paparazzo agencies and the lawyers and for, you know, Federline or this one or that one and all of their PR people, you know, and then just other random journalists and people who claimed they were friends of Britney. I mean, it was a scene. Like it was a happening.
As you were starting to move in these Britney proximate circles, was there skepticism lobbied towards you? Were they saying, oh, you want something that we're not prepared to give? Were people trying to hustle you? Certainly, if you read the story, it certainly seems like they were. Did you ever get the feeling that you, in fact, were getting close to a Britney interview, given all these efforts that you put in with all these different people?
Oh my God. I, you know, got hustled like I've never been hustled before in my life. I mean, everybody asked me for money to get like whatever piece of information about Britney. And, you know, some of that I found really sad. There's, you know, a person in this story, and I read the quote today, where he was really close with Britney in the earlier years when she, you know, first got famous. And he was like, you know, everybody used to manipulate her. Like she would be in her trailer and she didn't want to come out and she just wanted to hang out with her friends and like play her video games or whatever. And the label would come to me and they would say, you know, if you get Britney to come out of the trailer, we'll take you on a shopping spree for free. And I would go do it. And it's just so sad. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this story that is about the way this was kind of done to her, right? That she was a little girl. By the time she was six, she was winning her little beauty competitions and dance competitions. And then by the time she was eight, Lynn was taking her to try to get her into Mickey Mouse Club. She was too young. And then 12, she's finally in Mickey Mouse Club. And as you know, one of her managers said to me, she's a quarterback, right? Like, she's the one you want on that stage. Like, she will always hit all her marks. She will do everything right. And they thought, like, okay, now what do we do with this girl who's now 17, you know, and she wants to blow off steam? And the answer was not like, let's let her go back to Kentwood, Louisiana, and have a summer off and connect with her old friends. It was, let her party if she wants, let her go to clubs, let her do whatever other stuff she may have been doing, like all rock stars do, right? Because she doesn't have to be up early in the morning. That whole industry doesn't start till like 2 p.m. So, you know, that is the way that she was kind of taught how to deal with her issues and her anxieties, and everything was just all about hanging out and partying and being around other people.
And you also, in your piece, mentioned that in many ways, she was set up for those kind of circumstances by unseemly handlers, people who did not necessarily have her best interests at heart, but had access to her and could provide her with things. And that ends up setting the table for what proves to be a spectacular meltdown in 07 and 08.
It's a combination of, she was always looking for like a protector, but a lot of the people who she had access to, the men she had access to as protectors, you know, with the exception of Justin Timberlake, who everybody loves and will never say a bad word about, you know,
William Rass clothing line was corny. And so is the Man of the Woods album and Jordans.
Okay. Except for John. John will say bad things about Justin Timberlake. But I mean, when I was reporting this piece, the amount of people were like, if she had just stayed with Justin, you know, like as though everybody knows them and knows what would have happened if the two of them stayed together. But, you know, she looked to guys to take care of her. And a lot of those guys looked to her to get famous or for money or how she could be manipulated to be someone who was a bigger and bigger and bigger star. You know, there's this interesting question about Britney that always comes up, right? That is one of the great questions about her that nobody has ever been able to answer, which is like, did she know she was being sexualized, you know, in the Baby One More Time video? And did she care? And what did she think of it, right? And as time went on, why did she want to get more and more sexual? Was that because she wanted it? Or was it because the people around her wanted it? And I mean, I feel like my reporting just shows that everybody wanted it. Like, the guys wanted her to like wear, you know, boy briefs for a longer period of time, so then they could really have this like big bang when they made her super sexual. But everybody pretty much wanted her to be sexual.
The thing that I was really curious about after revisiting this piece and knowing we were going to talk, I think we've probably both worked on any number of pieces over the years where you're writing it as true and as straight as possible in the moment you write it. And then something happens 6 months, 12 months, 2 years later that you think, huh, it was, maybe it's that, maybe it's something else, maybe I acknowledge I didn't see or had no way to understand the circumstance. Given that Britney went into conservatorship, like that whole situation was really about to happen in the 6 to 12 months, and mental illness was going to become more of the focus, I wonder how you thought about Britney at that time, given what you had seen, and did it change what you felt about what you had seen during the reporting of the piece?
Yeah, I think at the time that I was reporting, there was so much focus with everybody about what are these drugs? You know, is it meth? Is it coke? What is going on here? Because nobody could understand what was making her seem so odd. And of course, you know, like in the piece, it says like maybe she has this adult onset of a genetic disease. But I mean, look, in the mid-2000s, people didn't talk about that so much, right? Like there was a lot of talk about drug addiction and Dr. Drew, but nobody would talk really about mental health. So, you know, it just wasn't part of the discourse. years. So I think that has certainly changed. But I also think that that's one of my regrets, certainly, is that I didn't handle that in a way that was sensitive. And I mean, there's so much in this story that's about, like, she's just like George Bush. Like, she's, like, just messing up our country. Just such an odd way of looking at the situation. But, you know, it's the very Rolling Stone kind of, like, middle finger. Yeah, like, the politics and the pop, it's all got to get better, man. So I'm not really sure why I decided to do all that. I mean, I think that there were, you know, look, there were people who were very connected to the case, you know, who, you know, a lot of the people who are not answering calls now, like who are talking to me. And I think that what they were saying was that she was in a manic state.
When I think about potential silver linings to the Britney story, big picture, there may not have been the language in the mid to late 2000s to say this very famous person has a mental illness or is mentally unwell. Whereas now, most famous pop stars speak openly about, you know, Bieber, Kanye, Selena, you know, it's just become part of the discourse now. And people are very transparent and open about it. And I think having that conversation out in the open maybe will help to cut off the oxygen that situations like the one that you wrote about need.
She doesn't say it. You know, I have wondered, like, would that really actually be helpful to her? You know, if she didn't feel like she had to put kind of this front on all the time and she could just relax. I mean, I do feel like she's just this incredibly tragic figure who made some really good music.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And this idea that, you know, she was just taken and put in this industry when she was so young and she had to handle so much. And it's not really the life that she chose for herself. I find really just very sad.
The particular era in which she became super famous, the convergence of tabloids, paparazzi, all that stuff, that was like pressure cooker stuff that just even 3 years earlier wouldn't have been the case. So she's the guinea pig for that entire generation.
And she was the guinea pig, you know, back in the late 90s, right? Like, what will the American public agree is okay for a 16-year-old to do that's sexy? And can we talk about whether she had breast implants or not? I don't think that there would have been as much pressure on her in so many different ways.
Vanessa, thanks for going back in the time machine with me to the wild days of your mid to late 2000s. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you, John.
That is our show. A minimum of toxicity, I hope. Thank you to Joe Coscarelli. Thank you to Vanessa Gregoriadis. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Tell me your deep, dark Britney secret favorite songs, or get on the Facebook group, start a thread. I'll jump in there with some sleepers. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get audio content. You know where that is: Apple, Google, Spotify, yada, yada, yada. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's listen to a little classic Britney. I'm not a girl, not yet a woman. Who can relate? I'm not a girl.